Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Dr. David Lebarski, Vice Chancellor and CEO at UC Davis Health. Welcome, Dr. Lebarski.
Thank you.
So what I always like to do before I really dive into the main part of the conversation is let each of my guests give a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So Dr. Lebarski, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you, Matt. It's a great pleasure to be here. I am the Vice Chancellor for Human Health Sciences at UC Davis Health, overseeing the medical school and the nursing school and all the related academic activities of our top 30 NIH-funded academic medical center. And at the same time, I am also overseeing our almost $3 billion a year health delivery system, which is a mainstay for the entire northern third of California.
That is a very large system. So what are some of the unique challenges that you faced overseeing kind of that diversity of a system?
Well, the greatest challenge is making sure that all of the people who count on us are getting exactly the type of care and the type of support that they need to live healthy lives. When you have such a large responsibility, for example, we're the only level one trauma center for 33 counties in Northern California, and the only academic medical center between San Francisco and Portland and between the Pacific Ocean and Nevada. You have a very large area to serve. And there are a lot of different types of constituencies from Sacramento's urban underprivileged to rural communities with limited access to healthcare, to rural hospitals who depend on us for the ability to transfer complex patients and to populate all of Northern California with the right type of trainees to meet a healthcare workforce needs, both nursing and medicine. So, honestly, every day I come to work thinking, you know, how can I best serve the region that UC Davis Health is supposed to be serving?
So kind of one of the things that you mentioned in there is, you know, you said you're an academic medical center. And, you know, I'm going to pick on that particular challenge out of the, you know, that broad array that you described, because I feel like, you know, academic medical centers fit a particular spot within the healthcare system. And it's one that people outside of it might not fully appreciate.
Right. What a lot of people don't know is that academic medical centers really are the backbone of healthcare in the United States of America, not instead of, but in partnership with all the other systems. As a matter of fact, the philosophy that I've promulgated while here has been that we're here to complete, not compete with other healthcare systems. When you look nationally, about 80% of all complex transfers from hospital to hospital occur from other health systems into academic medical centers. And that's because we do a great diversity of procedures, taking care of the sickest patients with multiple comorbidities, and we are designed to do that in the same way that a, say, aircraft carrier is designed to take jets and helicopters to the far reaches of the world, but you know what? They're not really great at transferring people from one side of the bay to the other, which is another important maritime function. So understanding where you sit and what you do and making sure that you're taking care of all the people that you are uniquely qualified to take care of, that's part of the job of the academic medical center, is to figure out how to do that.
And if, as you said, the academic medical center is, you know, from one frame, the repository or the source of care for all these patients that are or can be exceedingly difficult, one would imagine that the cost of delivering that care or the ability to be efficient with the delivery of care might not be the same as another type of hospital or another type of healthcare organization.
Right. We are very equipped with the latest and greatest technology and the highest and most trained subspecialists. So we have the largest subspecialty group by far in all of Northern California. And by definition, when you have such finely tuned subspecialists, you are not going to utilize them, you know, in the same way that a generalist would be used. And that is part of the cost of carrying the organization. And it does add costs. And as a matter of fact, you know, most academic medical centers have higher cost structures than their community hospital brethren, just because they are equipped to do a wide variety of complex care. And so they have to outfit themselves in order to meet that societal need.
And with those needs, how is that interacting with what feels like the broad push to drive healthcare into a value-based care mode, and with the well-reported state of things that there are just fewer dollars that are around for reimbursement?
All right. Well, it is a problem, because it's much easier to get to an efficient value-based care operation when you do things repetitively in great number. And when you do rare and complex things, it's not that easy to develop that level of iteration that leads to those efficiencies. On the other hand, by grouping the complex care in a place like an academic medical center, like grouping all of the heart transplants and liver transplants and kidney transplants and trauma care and complex pulmonary failure cases in a single place, you actually begin not to be incredibly efficient in low-cost care of that one patient, but lower-cost care for that population of patients, because you develop a certain rhythm and capability and full utilization of the subspecialists that lead to the best possible care at the lowest possible cost. Not necessarily a low cost, but at the lowest possible cost for that complex care.
That is a very interesting take on it, because you know, I think if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, it's, you know, not a case by case efficiency, but an overall efficiency in dealing with complex care, and combined with that, an ability to, you know, manage a high cost, you know, with the recognition that you're not going to make it a low cost, but you're going to prevent it from being an even higher cost.
Right, and that's exactly correct. So what we're doing is we're basically taking this complex need for coordinated care, which again, an academic medical center is uniquely poised to provide, and delivering it in a way that is the best possible way. And when there have been several studies out recently that show that while an initial episode of care at academic medical centers can be more expensive, the total cost of care, especially for complex patients, is the same or less, because we're grouping that care and actually doing that as good as it can possibly be done. Not we have the lowest cost for that initial hospitalization, perhaps, but we have the lowest cost and the best outcomes for that complex care across a time period of 90 days or a year or something like that.
So are there challenges in getting maybe like a policymaker or, you know, someone else who's talking about value-based care and not thinking in those nuances, but is just saying, oh, value-based care, we need to drive quality and we need to drive lower cost? You know, so kind of what are some of your means for, you know, increasing recognition for the, you know, as you said, the very important role that an AMC plays and the value of becoming an expert at efficiency, at efficiency of controlling a higher cost without having complications arise?
Right. So that's a great question. So the answer is, how do you actually make an academic medical center utilize its greatest attributes for the greatest percentage of its work that it can? And we've taken an approach here as to really pursue partnerships with other health systems who basically can probably provide routine care at a lower cost than we can. In fact, they do. And so, for instance, health systems like Dignity, now Common Spirit, or Adventist Health, or our local FQHCs, our federally qualified health centers, all through Sacramento, we're working as partners with them, trying to make sure that we get the right type of transfers and that we help them take care of their patients closer to their homes and their families. And I'll give you an example of this. So in working with an Adventist hospital a little ways away from our organization, we placed UC Davis pediatric hospitalists in their facility. And what that did is that allowed that hospital to take care of twice as many children as they were previously taken care of closer to home. And it allowed obviously kids should be next to their parents, right? And it shouldn't be inconvenient to follow them. But it also reduced the length of stay in that hospital by 20%. So it lowered overall costs. We got about the same number of transfers out of the deal, but the transfers were twice as complicated. And actually, the financial results, not only did we have great care for the more complex patients, but the financial results for UC Davis were positive as well, because we now got really complex patients for which we had the technology, the expertise, and the facilities to take care of those patients, and those facilities were being used to their highest level possible. So doing exactly what we should be doing, taking our very expensive cost structure and actually being able to break even on the transfers because we were fully utilizing our capabilities. That's the right thing, I believe, for academic medical centers to be doing, not competing for every single pediatric inpatient admission, but making sure, because we have a children's, one of the top 50 children's hospitals in the U.S. and the only one in Northern California, but making sure that we're not filling up our beds with people who can be treated closer to home. We're only filling our beds up with people who can't be treated closer to home.
Yeah, and that description really seems like just an extension on the drive to go to the right site, you know, what's arguably the right site of care for each particular patient. If, as you said, you're able to place your specialist in a more local hospital to improve the care there, and then that allows what sounds like an enhanced focus on the more complex patients at the main AMC, you know, it really does sound like that's a win-win, not for the organization, just for the organizations involved, but also for the patients.
Right. Most importantly for the patients, because, you know, in the past, someone, you know, first of all, some of those patients were, you know, bypassing the us locally and, you know, heading to the coast, but they really didn't need to do that. And that really wasn't good, especially for families. I mean, I know if you've ever had a kid, you know that if you have a sick kid, they want you right there by your side the whole time. And it shouldn't be a terrible journey for a parent in order to be able to do that.
Yes. No, I have a lot of very personal experience with that. It's not on major illness, but I know even on the minor illnesses, my children always say, sleep in our room when they're sick. And it's, you know, I think that just kind of underscores the point you're making, which is you always want to, especially if you're thinking about the pediatric side, just because I think they get more attention in this regard, but it's probably true for adults as well, is you want to be as close to home with the best possible care at all times.
Right. And that lends us right to, you know, some initiatives, not the first in the nation, but certainly be the first in the region. We're really trying to build out a digital platform that includes a 24/7 virtual hospital of all subspecialists so that we can help primary care providers or even generalists like general cardiologists or general surgeons who might be out there in the community deliver a higher level of care closer to home. That we're the academic medical center I oversee, our average noon census is 103% every day. We don't need any more patients. What we need are actually the sickest patients in the right setting and less sick patients, not in our hospital, but in someone else's hospital who can provide the care that is indicated. And by allocating the relatively high disease burden patients to academic medical centers, you make the very best use of their high cost structure. And it is also a very patient-centric approach because you're not making patients relocate away from their families when they don't really need to. You're doing via digital support, telemedicine support, the ability to keep those patients closer to home, adults or children.
And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Dr. David Lebarski from UC Davis Health. We've been talking about the role of academic medical centers. And Dr. Lebarski, I want to pick up on something you just talked about, which is, I believe you said you're working on the creation and rollout of a digital hospital. So could you explain more about what that is? Because I feel like I've heard reports of or seen stories about them, but it seems like it's not a fully well-reported issue yet.
Well, the idea is when you occupy, as we do, a unique role in our region where we really are the only academic medical center, as I've mentioned, in Northern California, and we have a really large subspecialty group, we don't want every patient driving 4 hours to see us only to get a checkup or a bit of advice that we might have been able to dispense digitally over usually telemedicine, but not only that way, and allow the local practitioner to provide that care with a little bit of support from us via an e-consult, for instance. As a matter of fact, the utilization of e-consults has been shown, that is, a subspecialist to a on-the-site provider, whether it's a primary care doc or someone else, can eliminate the need for subspecialty visits by 50%. And again, we have really long waits to get into our subspecialists. We don't need to see people that we don't need to see. So if there's a way to triage people and elevate the level of a care across every town and every city in Northern California through the support of UC Davis's subspecialists, I think there are 11 of our subspecialties are in the top 50 in U.S. News and World Report, and we're the number one hospital in Sacramento and number six in the state of California. We should be leveraging that out for all 33 Northern California counties that we serve. And we can do that.
Yeah, no, and I agree. That definitely makes sense because, as you said, I'm in the Northeast, and we, even though we're overly concentrated with physicians, access is an issue. And if, as you said, you can enable a reduction in visits by encouraging the use of telemedicine or telehealth, however you want to phrase it, again, it just goes back into a win-win for the entire system.
Right. And that's where partnerships are critical because if you develop a relationship with another facility and with their medical staff and therefore with their patients, you will end up being a trusted partner. And so when they need something, they will remember to send the sick patients to you. You will remain totally in business and thriving, and the rest of the region will be all the better off for it with a greater health for the entire population. It is truly a win-win situation that, again, provides the right type of care in the right setting, which at the lowest possible cost and the lowest possible inconvenience, the greatest degree of patient centrism that you can get.
And kind of with all the discussion that we've had so far about the high degree of specialty that an AMC can bring, and that you're using many examples to really help illuminate that point. Kind of the one aspect, or maybe not the one, but one of the aspects of an AMC that we haven't touched on yet is the academic part, which is, I imagine you're tied to a medical school and you've got medical students and residents involved with patient care and with all the care delivery operations. So I'm wondering, how does that have an impact on all the services that we've been talking about?
All right. Well, there's two or three different things. I'll point out that I was a chair of an academic anesthesia department for 16 years and had either nursing or physician trainees, a couple hundred at any one time. And so I'm very well aware of that from a on the ground level, which is you have to have, number one, a tremendous caseload so that of complex cases. So as people are trained, they really are able to take care of anything that the world throws at them, right? First and foremost, you need clinical caseload mix to really make for a robust training program. But the second part of this is you need an environment of inquiry because it's not only about training people about how we do things, but it's teaching people about how we keep pace with how we should be doing things or how we will do things. And so making sure that there are physician scientists and researchers constantly interacting with the medical students and the trainees is absolutely critical to make them lifelong learners who can critically read, appraise, and adopt new medical discoveries. So, and that takes money and that takes time and that take because you it's not like you're just providing clinical care all the time. You have to go to lectures, you have to do research projects, you have to do quality improvement projects and learn statistics. There are so many things that physician leaders and nursing leaders need to learn in the course of their career now in order to become leaders in medical care, and people who are going to push healthcare forward. You can't short circuit that and just teach them how we do clinical care today. And that is not well supported. It is sort of crazy, if I may, that the only reliable funding across the United States for graduate medical education is CMS, which is about a third of the patients in the hospital. And the other two thirds, the commercial insurers and in many states Medicaid, but not all, pay nothing towards graduate medical education, even though the future physicians will treat those patient populations. So I think we really need to get to a different level where all of graduate medical education and all the aspects that are necessary to turn out physician leaders of tomorrow are fully funded via the healthcare system.
Yes, no, your point about the fact that one of the main, if not the only sources of graduate medical education, as you said, is CMS. And you know, I feel like that point is not one that is necessarily widely known for people outside of healthcare, and certainly and maybe not even well within the full healthcare industry. It's in, you know, kind of, as you said, the constraints that that can impose also, you know, have an impact, because if you don't have enough money to really fund the educational efforts that you want to do, then it seems to, you know, it's kind of a ripple effect of the disservice that you're doing everyone.
Yeah, and arcane legislative rules that say that the number of residents that you had back in the 1990s is the maximum number that you can ever have for the rest of the life of an organization. And our organization has doubled in size. The population of California in that time has probably gone up 50%, and yet we're not allowed to train any more residents. But of course, we do, because we have an obligation to the workforce needs for healthcare in our state. But we do it 100% at our own cost. So that's another thing that lends itself to why we have a high cost structure here at academic medical centers, because I don't know if there's a single academic medical center in the United States who is not training the additional residents and fellows that are necessary, except at their own expense. And that makes no sense.
And you're kind of going back to the point you were making about, you know, needing to give the residents and the other physicians and clinicians in training, you know, broad exposure. You know, are you able to leverage the partnerships with the other community players that you were describing to tie into that training?
We are. And, you know, one of the things, we actually just got a almost $2 million grant from the AMA in combination with Oregon Health Sciences University, the next academic medical center up the coast, and a large number of rural hospitals in between, where we in order to teach and people how to take care of individuals in a rural setting, and also, frankly, to get medical students and residents to think about locating practices in rural America where there's a desperate need for additional access. We've set up novel educational programs that begin to expose people to those types of practices, in addition to our level one trauma center that does transplants and, you know, it's filled with ICU level patients, et cetera, because we want to make sure that, you know, all the service needs of our large and diverse community are met.
And kind of touching on the challenge that you said of, you know, trying to get, you know, physicians as they finish residency to go to rural health, and, you know, if I can, to add on top of that, you know, to remain in primary care as well, since, you know, it is, you know, I think that's another challenge. You know, what are some of the effective strategies that you've seen or that you're trying that are, you know, actually maybe having positive results in terms of getting physicians to go to rural health roles or to primary care roles?
All right. Well, that's a great question. We're ranked number 9 in primary care in the United States for a reason, is that we also have a couple of novel programs that have been lauded, one of which takes individuals who are committed to practicing in the mostly migrant farming communities of the Central Valley and provides a 6-year accelerated pathway back to primary care, hopefully back to their own communities, called ACE-PC. And it's an accelerated curriculum in education and primary care. We're seeing how that works out. We're getting near the end of our first cohort and seeing people relocate. But the idea is to take people who may not have to be quite honest with you, the highest USMLE scores, but have the community commitment, the cultural competency, the drive and the smarts, which may not always interpret to a perfect USMLE score, but does point to being a more effective physician for the communities they'll serve. So we have a very highly diverse workforce. And we've created a scholarship for those committed to working in the urban core in Sacramento as well, so that people can go back to underserved communities without tremendous financial burdens. And that's so at the end of the day, it's about financial aid. It's about medical school and training programs that laud, promote, and highlight the importance of going back and serving communities that do not have great access to healthcare, and setting up a very supportive environment for both medical students and trainees, who, like I said, they may not be perfect test takers, but that doesn't mean they're not going to be great physicians, and making sure that they succeed. We're not here to wash people out of our programs. I think that's a really important part. We're here to help people succeed within our programs. I think every medical school should take that approach, frankly.
Yes, no, the description of, you know, not necessarily focusing on standardized testing, which, you know, is a tough indicator to use as an indicator of, you know, how you'll actually be in practice, because, you know, isolating from, you know, a test room and then trying to extrapolate that out to actual human-to-human interaction is tough. So it's very encouraging to hear about the focus and the desire to promote, you know, and looking at, you know, kind of innate or inherent talent in individuals and then nurturing that.
Right. I mean, we are probably one of the most advanced programs in the nation in terms of the type of individuals that we see promise in and who have great promise, frankly. Just 65% of our class is socioeconomically disadvantaged. 73% are people of color. 60% are women. We truly have, really truly embraced diversity here at UC Davis and at UC Davis Health specifically. And that's because we believe that, we know the data is there, that when patients feel comfortable with, have trust in, and their physicians and physicians understand and nurses understand their patients, medications that are prescribed and therapies that are suggested are more likely to be followed. You are a more effective healthcare provider if you're part of the community. And that doesn't mean you have to be exactly like the person you're serving. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that a diverse workforce, though, brings better, fuller spectrum of better ideas into play in terms of how do we get people to adhere to the healthcare we're prescribing.
And with those very insightful comments, I unfortunately have to say, believe it or not, we're already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Dr. David Lebarski, for a great conversation today.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a true pleasure chatting with you, hopefully your audience found this interesting.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at #HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.